You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends,
a Q1 Network production.
If you have dreams or you're wondering how to make a bigger impact in this world, you're home. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. I'm Deb, Mike's wife. I suggested this idea as a way to keep him busy and out of my way after he retired. So far, it's working. Thanks for listening. It's time for Mike Seminary and Friends.
Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, the place where we strive to make a difference, a positive difference, provide you something of value. Heck, from my perspective, we just want to share good stuff. I'm your host, Mike Seminary, and I'm so grateful you've joined us. A big thanks to my friend David Hansen for my theme music, Continental Drift. Search for his work, Serotonin Waters and Moon Dot Soup, on iTunes and Spotify. By the way, I appreciate your comments and guest suggestions. Keep them coming at MikeSeminary.com or Mike Seminary and Friends on Facebook. And please visit us at Apple Podcasts and leave a review.
Today, I'm just thrilled to have a remarkable entrepreneur, creative genius, philanthropist, devoted, loving husband and father, and frankly, my dear friend, Shane Balkowitz. Shane, welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. Thank you for taking time to join me. It's great to see you. How are you?
I'm good. It's an honor, Mike. It's really an honor.
We met in 2014. I think it's important for followers and listeners to learn how we met because it was interesting. I received a message from this fellow named Shane. He wanted to meet me, and he was telling me in the message about this wet plate photography. That's probably not the best way to describe it, but that's how I remember it. And he'd like to take my picture. And I had never met Shane. I didn't know of him. I knew the last name because of the business that he had started, but I didn't know him. And then he used a name of someone that I know, so I called the fellow and said, tell me about Shane. That was in September of 2014. And I have grown to just love Shane Balkowitz. He's one of the most remarkable people. Aside from his success in business, he's a change agent. He's doing remarkable things with a talent that he didn't have much before when we met. So that's kind of how I want to start our conversation, Shane. You were a successful business guy, and you reached a point in your life where you were exploring ways to be more creative. Tell us about that journey.
Well, yeah, I was 44 years of age. I had been searching for some years. It occurred to me that with all the successes that I had in my life, that this could not be it. Like, what is this all about now? And I've said this before, is we all struggle in life. You know, we all try to, you know, we're all trying to feed our families and pay for rent and all the struggles that we all have throughout our lives. But at some point, when you acquire some wealth or some ability to not be struggling paycheck to paycheck, and again, it took me years and decades to get to that point in my life. But at some point, when I got to that point, I started asking, "What is the meaning of all this? So now that I don't have to struggle as much, What is the purpose of all this stuff? The meaning of life? Why are we here? What is this about? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be here at this time in this place? And I was just looking. I bought a 14-inch telescope, looking at the stars, trying to understand. Read books and books and books about the universe and black holes and everything that you could reading everything Carl Sagan had ever written. And I just dove into this, trying to understand where my place is in this universe. And I felt like I was killing myself at my job. I just felt like I had been doing that. As of this podcast, I've been doing this for 23 years now. So, but back in 2012, I think I was burnt out, and I just knew that there had to be something, some other reason for me to be what I was doing. And I was kind of naive, and I've had these conversations with you before. I was kind of naive, thinking that my legacy was going to be my business work, for somehow I was going to hand this down to my daughters or my son, and that was going to be who I was going to be known for. And little did I know, once I found a camera, that my life would take a complete turn, and I would find the answer to what I was looking for.
So I called you, and you asked me to come to your studio that was actually in the place of business that you just referenced. And that's the first time we met.
If you want to call it a studio, yes. It was, I should explain to the listeners, it was a corner of a 4,000 square foot warehouse with no exterior light windows whatsoever. A very strange place to take photography.
And the whole time I was there, and I think I was there for about 3 hours.
You were
somewhere,
yep,
in that area.
And I think you said, well, you know, I can give you an hour. I think there were some conversations of what your schedule was like, and where, yeah, I can get this done in an hour. And we ended up spending 3 hours, I want to say, together that day.
I think you took my image. I don't want to say a photograph. You captured my image 6 or 7, 8 different ways that day, maybe six.
I could find out. I mean, I got them all saved, all the scans. So the history's there. Once any one of my works, once I take a picture of someone, it's always archived, and I'm always able to go back to it. So I could tell you exactly what order we took them, on what day we took them, and so forth.
And what I remember so vividly is you were so engaged in what you were doing, but you were also very conscious of letting me know what you were doing, how this process works, how you came upon it. And folks, for you that are listening, this is the original photography. This is, if you saw a picture of Abraham Lincoln or something, like, this is the type of photography we're talking about. And I'll never forget all the information that you were sharing, and I was absolutely jaw-jacked because I was learning from you, and you were so passionate. And while you're educating me, you're also so conscious of the creative piece, where I'm saying to myself, this guy's remarkable. And you'd only been doing it about 2 years.
Right.
To date, how many images have you captured?
3,894.
How has the process evolved from, and I don't mean to go into the weeds too much, but how has the process evolved or modified from the day I was there, September of 2014, to the images that you're capturing many times on a Friday, by the way, we'll get to that later. How has that evolved during that period of time?
Well, I think I've learned a lot more. You said I had some knowledge back in 2014. I probably didn't know anything back in 2014, to be honest. I've honed my skills a little bit with the knowledge on purpose, because I have the absolute pleasure of having students out from the University of Mary and Bismarck State College. I have between 5 and 6 classes. I've got different colleges come from all over the state to come and spend the afternoon in my studio, because I'm able to show the students something that they can read about in the history books, but they have no tangibly, they have no way of being able to see it in person. And to bring them in, these instructors, they think it's really good to show them the infancy. So, you know, they're going to obviously practice digital, but if you know analog, if you not only know an analog, I'm not talking about 1950s film photography, I'm talking about 1851 wet plate collodion photography. If you know that intimately, or you get a taste of it, you get to see it, you get a real rich appreciation for where we are today. So when you're immersed in one of these older processes, these students, they come in and they're just, they just don't understand it, because they don't... where they sit and the technology at their disposal is not what I'm showing them. And it's this big aha moment for them. To answer your question, I mean, the big thing is that I changed from that warehouse with no windows to building the first natural light wet plate studio of its size in the country in over 100 years. So I read, Dr. Raymer wrote a definitive book in 1903, I want to say, 1906, if my memory serves me right. And he gave diagrams and stuff. If you're going to build a photography studio with natural light windows, which I knew I wanted to do because I started taking, I took your portrait in the studio using modern day UV lights. So I need electricity to make photography. So I was cheating, if you think about it that way, because in 1851, Frederick Scott Archer, the man who invented this process, he did not have light bulbs. So he was not turning on a bulb at 9 o'clock at night and taking a wet plate photograph. So we could only take photographs during the day. And when I first started leaving the security of that back warehouse and going out, and I shot that first photograph of my brother standing by his pickup and that first photograph of my mom sitting on a chair just out in sunlight, I knew that to take my work to the next level, I had to use the sun. And that's where I started researching this natural light photography studio, where you have to have your windows facing north, so this beautiful non-direct light with no shadows comes into the studio. So I took the dimensions, the pitch and everything from Dr. Raymer's book 115 years ago and applied that to my modern day studio and built a studio in my backyard.
For the record, if you went to my Facebook page, you will see, particularly on the profile side, two examples of Shane's work. One on, they call it the wall, whatever it is. That photo, which is also the image I use for Mike Seminary and Friends, my podcast, that image was captured September of 2014. The other image you see, was it last year during COVID or just before COVID? Just before COVID hit, in the natural light studio that Shane just referenced. And just as a side note, back in September of 2014, I don't know that we did it 2 years ago, there was this device that, because you have to hold your pose for about 10 seconds.
Long exposures. So just to, not to interrupt you.
Go ahead, please.
But your iPhones, for the listeners who are with their iPhone cameras, they're taking photographs in about 1/60th of a second. Okay, so that shutter opens up for 1/60th of a second. When you come into my studio and I'm using natural light, using the archaic photographic technology, it's 10 full seconds. So it takes me 600 times longer. And that's what I'm trying to get at to help you is to take your photograph than it is with modern day photography. So we have these head braces that hold you into place. And all those, this isn't my novel idea. I mean, this is my actual head braces was cast from a mold made from an original head brace back in the Victorian era. So all those photographs of Sitting Bull, or Abraham Lincoln you referred to, all those photographs, if it was a studio shot, rest assured that there was a head brace holding them in place. You just don't see it. It's just out of frame behind the person's head. So this is their modern day technology and how they were trying to solve these issues of these long exposures. And it wasn't until later, in the early 1900s, when photography got much, much quicker, and you could even do like a candid smile and so forth in photography. And so it's a different animal completely, but it's such a romantic and beautiful process. It's the great-great-grandfather of photography, and we can't stand on, use this technology today on our iPhones without tipping our hats a little bit to these previous inventors of these photographic techniques, because that's how we get to the modern day is through the past.
Before we move on to projects that you've developed and have some coming up, the other thing I recall is as I'm on the head brace, you also said, now you can't breathe because you wanted as little opportunity for movement at all. Mm-hmm. And that 10 seconds seemed long. Even though I could hold my breath a long time, it seemed long because I felt kind of a little pressure because I don't want to screw up this moment. I never shared that with you. So it was kind of like, oh man, and I got to make sure I don't breathe. I can't move. I don't want to even bat an eyelash because this was historic for me too. Yeah, you need to know that.
That's what's beautiful about this is that 10 seconds we all take, and I tell this to the students, we all take these 10 seconds of our lives for granted. We'll, you know, brush our teeth or comb our hair, or whatever we can. Just imagine all the things that you do in a day that you spend 10 seconds on that are meaningless. Okay, not that brushing your teeth is meaningless or combing your hair is meaningless, but just think about all those wasted, and I'm going to say it, wasted 10 seconds of your life that if you were attentive to those 10 seconds, like you had to be, the beauty of this also is that you have to perform as the sitter. Is I can be the most brilliant photographer behind the camera, and I'm not, but I could be, and that doesn't matter if you don't do your job as the sitter. So the sitter gets pulled into this dance with me, and you have to perform, and I have to perform to get something magical. So it's all about the intent, and it's all about that 10 seconds, because we're transferring that 10 seconds, and we should tell your listeners, into pure silver images. So instead of taking a snapshot in that 1/60th of a second, I've got 10 full seconds of Mike Seminary's life captured in silver. And actually, it's a movie. It's a still life movie. I'm purposefully asking you, don't move, Mike. I could have you move all the way around and you'd be blurry and I'd still get 10 seconds of your life. I just would not be able to visualize it as well. So I'm asking you to hold still for 10 seconds. So I have 10 seconds of your life. As an oncology nurse by trade, I know your heart's going to beat maybe 8 to 10, 12, 14 seconds, depending on how fit you are. You're going to take a couple, maybe a shallow breath here. You're going to have a blink. And what I really love about this process, and I tell my sitters before, if I got that feeling at the time, I'll have that sitter. If I know that they're really into that moment, I ask them to think about something that's important to them because that thought can transfer to the plate.
Help me understand something. When this became the passion in terms of the whole package to be somewhat crude, there was no instruction book. You can go down to Bob's photo and find what you needed. So first of all, you had to educate yourself, which meant you accessed as much information as you could online and otherwise to learn. Once you learned what was required, and that's an ongoing prospect, I understand, how did you determine where to go to find the tools that you needed to make this work?
Well, I was never a photographer. I never even owned a camera before 2012. So we should tell your listeners, I tell this story so many times, but I should tell it really quickly, is that I saw how I got into wet plating as I saw a photograph online and I asked the photographer what it was. There was something magical about it. I don't know what it was that's so magical to me. I have that photograph saved on my hard drive at home. I can look at it. It was a picture of a motorcycle with two very out of focus people behind it. And there's reasons why the people are out of focus and the motorcycle's in focus. His name is Paul DeLoreans. He was not a podcaster, but he had a blogger. He has the largest, it's called The Vintagent. It's the largest motorcycle blog in the world. And he was traveling across the United States taking wet plate photographs. And I asked him, well, what is that? And he told me it was wet plating. It was wet plate. And I got onto Google and I did some searching. And here's this archaic process. And I've always liked history. That's one other thing I should say that maybe was drawn into me. But I could look at that photograph of that motorcycle and those two out of focus people. And I'm not insulting Paul here. But there's nothing about that photograph that would grab you by the throat and say, follow me. There's absolutely nothing. I can look at it today. I looked at it in 2012. It drew me in for some reason. I can look at it in 2021, nearly 9 years later. There's nothing about that photograph that would like draw me into where and saying, I have to do that. I don't know why that was. I asked him about it and he says, well, are you a photographer? And I said, well, I don't even own a camera. He said, you know, very nicely, he said, there's no way a non-photographer will ever teach himself wet plating. Within 45 days of that conversation, I had made my first plate. But I didn't know anything about cameras, and not only regular cameras. I mean, these are Bellos, large format cameras. These are, okay, now, I have to have a darkroom. I had never stepped into a darkroom before. The first darkroom I ever walked into was the one that I created myself. I mean, that's a very daunting and difficult task. If you know, it's one thing to have a mentor or someone that could say, oh, put his arm around you. Come over to my darkroom. I'll show you. These are the trays you need. This is the light you need. This is everything that you need in your darkroom to, you know, this is my workflow, all that stuff. I figured it out, just trial and error. And that's how I've taken this entire process, is it's just been trial and error. And when you came out, I honestly say I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I honestly, and if you look at those first photographs, and you know, I can share that with you, it's obvious that I obviously didn't know what I was doing. But I didn't quit. I kept making these small little, you know, at first you make these, and some of your listeners, they can apply this to many things in your life. You can, at first you're going to make these huge gains, these huge jumps, boom, boom. I'm improving. That's all well and good, but it's when you start trying to master something, it's those little baby steps. It's those little changes that you have to make in order to take it to the next level. So it's not these big, huge strides that I was taking early on in those early months. It's something more subtle. It's something more elusive. And I just, you know, I never want to take the perfect portrait. I just never want to do that. I want to continue to search out the perfect portrait, because over this last 3,700 or 900 plates or whatever I've made, I can remember back in time that I thought at one point, that's the best photograph I've ever taken. And I have these images. I know these portraits in my mind, and that's the best portrait I've ever taken. And that's the best portrait. So what I've learned is that I don't know what the best portrait that I can take yet. And maybe I'll find it. You know, the last day in my studio, I'll be 90 years old and I'm about to collapse, and I'll find that last exposure will be the best portrait I'd ever taken. And then we can just call it quits and I can expire right there in my studio.
Well, before we move on, you say you didn't know what you were doing. I'll never forget the time in the studio, the first time at the warehouse, not the second time at the Natural Light Studio. I'll never forget taking the plate, putting it in the tray, and then you're adding
fixer.
Thank you.
Pouring the fixer on the plate.
And I think we were recording it with our iPhones. I was absolutely shocked. It was like watching something being born. It was absolutely amazing. The other thing I remember, Shane, it was almost like, if any of you have ever been in a play or a musical and you go to the wardrobe or the costume room, there are all of these costumes that will be worn in this particular play or musical or the next one. So Shane has a variety of costumes and wardrobes and
I had. I don't in my Natural Light studio anymore. So it's something that I've gotten away from.
But you were so creative. It's almost like a mad scientist kind of creativity. That's when I said to myself, this guy is really, really creative. You have great vision. By the way, why don't you do that anymore?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever asked me. I think I was searching for my creativity. And it occurred to me at one point, I had a bunch of hats and I had different, like you said, different outfits and costumes and stuff like that. And it occurred to me at some point that my sitters bring enough character into the studio that I don't need to play. I mean, we don't need to play sometimes. And I have a lot of creative work. If anyone does a search of my work on Google or something, I have a lot of creative work where I'll get certain props and outfits and stuff to create make a creative piece. But just to have, like, Mike comes in and throw a hat on him, to me, it just seems like it's not Mike. But if Mike comes in with his own hat, it's a completely different story. So I had shot, you know, different people and it just seemed like I was not given as much respect to my sitters as I should. And maybe my work was becoming more serious. And maybe this is only my own perception. I don't ever judge my own work. I leave it up to other people. So I'm absolutely too close to my work to say if it's good or not. I mean, I rely on other people to tell me what they think, if they like this or not. I just, you know, I in my heart, I know what I like, but what I found is what, a lot of times what I like, it's not what other people like. So there's that strangeness there as well. So, reenactors, I used to shoot a lot of reenactors, used to go over Fort Abraham Lincoln and stuff like that. I don't do any of that anymore because I just, you know, when you have Evander Holyfield, the 4-time heavyweight champion of the world, coming into your studio, you've shot in Greta Thunberg. These are, and not that every person's a real person, but these are people that bring their own character in. And I don't need to embellish that. I mean, there's something about stripping everything away anyway. You strip everything away and you just get down to the person. And that's what I'm trying to do. And that's why you haven't asked the question yet, but that's why I shoot portraits instead of landscapes or something like that, because there's something innately human about a portrait. If you see a portrait that's 150 years old and you don't know who they are, the person, or what their job was, or who the photographer was, or even what continent the photograph was taken on, you're still intrigued by who that person was. You may like or not like the photograph, but there's an intrigue. There's a connection between you and that portrait, and that's what I love about portraits, humanize it. And I only have a small handful, a very small handful. I'd probably say maybe less than 5 plates of that whole voluminous amount that I've captured over this last nearly 9 years that do not have human eyes in them.
By the way, for listeners and followers of Mike's Seminary and Friends, when you're in Bismarck, Shane just mentioned Evander Holyfield. There is an electrical box wrap right on the corner of 3rd and...
Outside of Borrowed Bucks,
right on the corner of Borrowed Bucks. Of that particular image of Evander Holyfield. It's really special.
It's actually Virgil Hill on that.
Oh, that one's Virgil.
That's okay. Virgil Thank Hill. You. And on the opposite side of that is Ernie LaPointe, the great grandson of Sitting Bull. And then on the north and south side of that same box is this portrait without eyes of the state capitol building. So they asked me, well, what do you want to put on the north and south side? I had these two portraits. I'm like, well, I can't fit a portrait there. So I figured out how to take my picture of the state capitol building, which kind of put the place, where I've grown up. I was born and raised here. So yeah, that was Virgil Hill. And that's how Evander actually came into my studio. And the photograph of Evander Holyfield is in the Smithsonian Institute in their portrait gallery. The first photograph they've ever had of the man in their portrait gallery. So it was a huge honor.
We'll come back to the Smithsonian in a moment. You also do large stages or settings, whatever.
Collaborative pieces.
I think was the first one, Murderer's Gulch.
It was, yep.
Downtown Bismarck. I was there watching. It was just absolutely amazing. The next one's coming up July 17th.
Yes.
And it's called No Vaccine for Death.
Correct.
You were given permission to use the University of Mary Grotto.
Yep.
By Monsignor Shea.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about the idea and how that will work that day.
Merrick Deuce is my director. He's also a professor out there at the University of Mary, and he's always directed these big, large collaborations. And this collaboration here on July 17th, and anyone who, if this podcast drops before then, is welcome to join us on that day out at the Grotto. It's a community event. It's something that I always love collaborating. We have people that are working on wardrobes. We have prop masters. We have carpenters. We have hair and makeup. And we've done these large collaborations. This will probably be the largest wet plate collaboration of all time. We have over 100 people involved. I've never been able to find it where I see a photograph of 100 people got together and made a wet plate together of any image. So No Vaccine for Death, it was, you know, a lot of the previous collaborations were my idea, like the concepts that I had come up with. And Merrick has been so generous with his time and being my director all these years. So I get to just do my camera work and I let him manage the scene. Okay. Which is, it's really fun. I really like that friendship that builds from creating together. And so I asked him, what should we do? You know, we didn't get to do anything last year because of COVID. And he thought to put a stamp on this virus, to, you know, to put this behind us once and for all, that we should address the pandemic. So there's a painting from the 1500s that we're using as our inspiration. And death is in the form of skeletons, and these skeletons are attacking. What's really important about the photograph, the painting, and what's inspiring us is that these skeletons represent the plague back in the day. And the plague doesn't care who you are. And I think that's a lesson that we've learned here in the last year as well. It doesn't matter, because you look at on the left-hand corner of this painting, and there's the king on his backside and the skeleton standing over him. So the plague got to the king. And then you see the pauper, and then you see the farmer, and then you see, you know, all the young ladies and debutantes. And then you see the religious people, and it doesn't matter who you are. Some people, and the other lesson is, you know, something that we saw too, you had some people cowering. There's people under tables hiding from the plague, which represented again by skeletons. But then there's other people that are fighting the plague. I mean, they got swords out and they're actually trying to valiantly fight against this. But the story is that nobody's going to win. Like, this is good. Nobody's going to beat this thing, and it doesn't care who you are. And I think that's a good message. So Merrick came up with that. That's what the painting he sent over. And I said, if you look at the painting, there's like 5,000 skeletons in this painting. So there's no way we could pull it off in that scale, but we can use it for inspiration, because you have to understand this team of people that I have, that I've gotten together for these collaborations, and they're the same people. And we always add new people, I should say, especially now that we have, I want to say, Liberty Trudges Through Injustice, which is our last big one. There's 52 people. So, but you need to, allow everyone to collaborate, and, it just becomes this fun day. And we don't do it with any budget whatsoever. These large collaborations, it's all about creating these people. Everything that you see in my images, these large images, our images, I should say, are things that were brought to the table by people. And it's no other reason than to create. And everyone gets a limited edition print for participating. And then we just go on our merry way. And then we figure out what we're going to do next. But it's called No Vaccine for Death, because Merrick, and I hope if he's listening, I don't botch his idea, but he saw during the pandemic a lot of people were afraid. And he thought that if everyone really looks at this, and again, I'm an oncology nurse, so if I get a little dark or whatever like that, I apologize, but I have a different perspective holding the hands of people that have died, quite a significant number. I have a different perspective on life than some people. Or I have a comfort level of talking about death and dying that other people may not have. But he thought that everyone already has a disease that's killing him. It's called being a human. And we're all dying now. So the question is, what do you want to do? What are you going to do with your life now? That you're already, Mike, you're dying. I'm dying. I mean, I don't have any problem saying that. I'm 52 years old. I'm dying. I'm only going to be here a finite amount of time. And what do you want to do? How do you want to be remembered? What people do you want to touch? And what difference do you want to make in your time here? Because it surely cannot be when we had lunch last week, the absurd quest of profit and loss statements that I had chased a majority of my adulthood. It cannot be there. I've looked, I pulled the sheet back. I went to that corner, pulled the sheet back. I looked there, and I could put the sheet back and say, it's not there. Where is it? And right now, it's in my photography.
I'm going to use the pandemic to kind of tee up your incredible work. I have a book in front of me, Northern Plains Native Americans, A Modern Wet Plate Perspective. It's first of a series of four.
Four, yes.
And a lot of this was underway when the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. How did dealing with the pandemic impact your ability to stay on course, if that's the right way to look at this? Because you're very disciplined. You have a schedule that you keep, and you're booked
7 months out right now.
7 months out. How did that impact you and your sitters, your guests?
Well, it was a bunch of cancellations. So right away it was like, I cannot believe this Friday. And Friday just happens, I should explain, that Monday through Thursday, I pay for this debacle running Bulkwich Enterprises. And Fridays, and for since my studio, the moment my studio was built, the following Friday, I'd not go into work that day. And I have not gone into work any Friday since the studio was built. So it's kind of been my gone down to 4-day work weeks. It's a dream come true. My wife is very supportive. She knows that this is, you know, Shane's worked really hard on what he, you know, to get us where we're at. And Fridays is his time. So I get up in the morning, I'm down to the studio, and I'm just doing my thing, which is amazing. I mean, how fortunate am I that, you know, there's so many other people that don't have that opportunity to have this creative day. I mean, I know so many artists that would just die to just say, Friday is your day. Just paint or do a sculpture or write music or do poetry or whatever you want to do. It's an amazing opportunity. So I cherish my Fridays. So I canceled a lot of my sitters. I was booked out for months and I didn't, I was not going to not go down to my studio on that Friday. So right away it was like, okay, my Native American series and my other friends that were coming in, we have to lock down. We're all quarantined. So I said, well, I'm here with my family. So I started taking my family back down there and we started a COVID, isolation series. That is actually, there's 10 plates for that series. And those plates are archived permanently at the Plains Art Museum. And it shows, I did Girl with Virus, my daughter Olivia, where I found this little round ball with all these little knobs on it, a little red ball. And then I had her paint little white dots on the top of each one of the knobs. And it kind of, if you look at what scientists think the pandemic look, or the virus actually has the physical form, if they have a vision of it, this looks very much like the virus. So as soon as I saw that ball, it was like, that's the virus. And so I had Olivia come down and I asked her to put on her prettiest dress and she did. And it, again, I collaborated with my, you know, 9-year-old daughter at the time. It's like, Olivia, what do you want to wear tomorrow for the shoot? And what shoes are you going to wear? What dress do you want to wear? And she picked all this stuff out and she painted the ball, another part of the collaboration. So I'm even collaborating with my young daughter. And we went down to the studio. I set the ball on the ground and put the head brace on her and put a gas mask on her. And here's this become a rather viral, iconic image of this young girl in a pretty dress standing, looking down at what appears to be the coronavirus. And that was called Girl with Virus, kind of inspired by Bansky has a girl with balloon. I don't know if you've seen that image. People have saw the reference there that I somehow had that in my mind when I created that Girl with Virus. And so we just started doing plates. I did one with Grayson, my son Grayson. I built a crucifix, put my son putting a crucifix over his shoulders or putting his arms up and had a gas mask on as well. The idea behind that image was that even our deities, and you don't have to be religious to understand this. I mean, I was playing a little bit off. I'm a Catholic and I was an altar boy. And I mean, so I was playing off the Catholicism and stuff of our stories, but it could be applied to anyone. And the message in that plate was that nobody is impervious to that. If this disease, and again, I'm playing with ideas here, if this disease can hurt our deities or our gods or whatever have you, it can get any of us. And so I came up with a series of plates. I did a plate with my wife in a nice dress with an open back. And she had a mask on and she was looking really pretty and just playing off these different themes and trying to continue to create during the pandemic.
She is pretty. And your whole family,
she is
gorgeous family and so supportive of what you do. And you mentioned that, by the way, in the book. You're blessed with a very supportive, wonderful family. Awfully good looking. I don't know how you managed to pull that one off, Shane.
I have no idea either. But I mean, I think they would even admit themselves that they didn't really, you know, is dad going off the rails here? What is this? So I was never an artist at all of any principle at all. And here I'm taking photographs now. It just seemed really out of character for me.
Was it ever a conversation? Dad, are you going off the rails?
Well, I don't.
Since you brought it up.
No, I don't know if it was a conversation, but it was, you know, I just kind of, you know, I felt that myself is that why do you have this this draw? Why are you chasing this so vigorously? What is it about this that you are all in for somewhere? And I've always, you know, I mean, you know me long enough. I'm all in on a lot of things in my life. And it seems like whenever I dive into something, it's either all in or not. And even at my own peril. So it doesn't, you know, it's not always a positive thing either. So it is a limitation of me, and it's one of my faults that I chase things very vigorously. But this seemed to linger more, you know, the telescope. I was, you know, I used to golf. I had a golf green in my backyard. I haven't touched a golf club since I found a camera. So, I mean, there's things that have come and gone, but nothing's held my attention like this. And I just don't feel like, you know, at 52 years of age, I have enough time yet to do what I want to do with this. So it's a bit of a race.
How did this passion for addressing the history of mistreatment for our Native American brothers and sisters, how did that surface for you, and then you decided this is what I must do? Because it is a remarkable work that you're putting together, Shane. And God bless you for it.
Oh, thanks. The series is going to be 1,000 portraits, and as you, I'm 7 portraits away from 500, so volume 2. So there's 1,000 portraits, every 250 portraits there will be a volume. So in front of you is volume 1, and who graces the front of that that book there in front of you? This is the limited edition version that I'm sold out of. Is Ernie Lapointe, the great grandson of Sitting Bull? I didn't have any Native American friends at all when I took this portrait, that portrait on that day. I had no Native American friends in my life, had no associates in my life, had never known a Native American at all. And Ernie came in, and Orlando Scott Goff was a wet plate artist that took Ernie's great-grandfather Sitting Bull's portrait in Bismarck, North Dakota, in the same process. I want to say in 1882, I want to say is when that was done. And so I looked up Ernie in the phone book, got him, he picked up the phone and asked him to come. And he knew about the photograph that Goff had taken. Obviously, he knows a lot more about his grandfather's heritage and life than I did. And he came in and as a complete stranger, drove in from South Dakota. And we spent that day together. And it was just a remarkable day. Ernie taught me many things on that day. And he continues. I just spoke with him last week. He teaches me every time I talk to him. And he's been up for all my book signing and my documentary that's on Amazon. And all, he's always been here supporting me. But it was that day and it was the response to that photograph that's on the front. It's called Eternal Field. And it's nothing more than Ernie Lapointe standing in a field. There's that little highway that's comes south of the University of Mary that goes to the airport, between the airport and University of Mary. That's in the background there. There's actually, Ernie tells a story. He says, I thought you were crazy because there were semis and cars and stuff driving behind him. He knew this. He could feel this while he's standing in that field. He's going, well, how is this going to work? And I knew darn well that they were moving too fast to actually capture these vehicles. So there was vehicles driving behind him during this. It looks like a little river there, but it's actually you know, it looks like maybe a bank of a river, but it's actually a highway. And there was a waste management dumpster just 5 feet out of frame that you don't see in this portrait. But it was the response to this photograph, Eternal Field, with my very now dear friend, Ernie Lapointe. This was the first photograph that ever got into any museum. I have my works in 32 different museums around the globe. And the State Historical Society identified this photograph, and they said they'd take it. So this was the first ever photograph of mine, wet plate of mine, that ever made it into a museum. And it holds a special place in my heart. And it was that response and Ernie's response to the image and people's, you know, response online. Again, I told you earlier, I'm too close to my work to know if it's good or not. I just have to – I put myself out there. I share my images freely, and I really don't worry too much about anything else. I just let them be. And it was that response that, you know, I got, you know, the idea that maybe I should, you know, maybe the first idea was just to do 10 Native American portraits, Ernie's being the first. So that was the very infant version of my today's goal. So when I got to 10 photographs, it's like, you know, as a not having any other Native American in my life other than Ernie at the point, how am I going to find 9 other people to come in? But you know, Dakota Goodhouse from the United Tribes. He was portrait number two. Just from there, it just continued. And I've never advertised for it or anything. It's just been word of mouth, me sharing the images. About 8 weeks ago, Miss Native American World flew in from Florida. I got two of her plates into the Florida Historical Society, one into our Historical Society here. I had a young lady and her family drive all the way in from Washington State about 4 weeks ago. And her plate got into the Washington State Museum and got into our museum here. So I never would have, and it's called Northern Plains Native Americans, because how could I have ever, when I started this, think that anyone outside of, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, or Minnesota was ever going to, you know, travel. But here I find, so even the title for the series kind of shows my ignorance a little bit. But it is what it is. But there's tribes from all over the country have come in, from all over Arizona, Texas. Deb Haaland, the first Native American congresswoman, now our Secretary of the Interior, the first Native American Secretary of Interior. She just texted me yesterday. So, I mean, I took her portrait over 2 years ago, and here I continue to – the day that she got – I got to tell the story real quick. Deb Haaland, very good friend now. And I think that's kind of where, you know, what kind of pattern are we seeing here, right, Mike? Mike, you come in as a stranger, and we're friends of this day. Deb Haaland comes in as a stranger, we're friends of this day. All these people come in as complete strangers, and I continue to be friends with them much later. And it's so important. But the day that she got nominated, or no, the day that she was confirmed as the Secretary of the Interior, the first Native American Secretary of Interior, I was in my studio. And she called me on the phone, spent 15 minutes with me on the phone. I'm like, Deb, you possibly cannot be. I'm getting goosebumps telling you the story. Deb, you possibly have to have something more important than to be on the phone with me. And do you know what her answer to that was? She goes, no, I do not. And I, what do I say to that? What do I say to that?
Nothing. It's just, I'd like to ask you this question. I've had Native American friends since first grade, growing up over in Fargo. And a mutual friend, Scott Davis, yep, helped me a lot with understanding cultural differences. When it came to some of those cultural sensitivities with regards to touching or handling items that they might bring with them, how did you handle that?
I just asked.
Okay.
I just asked permission. That's a very good question. Like even last week, the gentleman that came in to my studio, I saw his hair was just little kittywampus. It just wasn't – I was looking at him in the camera and, you know, I just asked permission. Can I touch your hair? Can I pick up this drum? Can I – this bow and arrow here, can I touch it? I mean, you know, you just – if you ask permission – and you're given that permission, it's a remarkable thing. But you have to have the understanding of you should be asking these things. And it's not something in your culture and my culture that, you know, we don't – I can pick something up off your desk, Mike, and I don't feel too – you know, like I'm going to infringe on anything. But you know, Ernie was instrumental in that. Ernie, you know, when I have guests in, anytime Ernie comes to my studio, I have tobacco for him. He taught me that first day. He says, you know, if you have Native Americans in and you want to give them a gift, tobacco is a really good gift. So every time Ernie comes, I have a tin of tobacco for Ernie, and he laughs at it because he knows that it was something that I listened to him back then, and he's taught me so much. But you have to be able to want to listen. You have to want to appreciate, and you have to have you know, respect for other people's cultures, and just understand that they're not your cultures. I should just say, not this last Friday, but the Friday before, I was gifted two falcon feathers from. Mr. Great Cloud came in, and before he left, and I have a bunch of gifts that I've been given over the time. I've been given vests and all kinds of things. And your listeners need to understand that when you're given a gift from a Native American, like a vest, and I wear that vest, like I did for the opening for my documentary that came out, I'm honoring them. I'm not, there's no cultural appropriation. And I've had people try to call me out for this before. You know what I mean? Like, you shouldn't be wearing this. This was a gift from this person to me. And I honor them by wearing it. And they give me permission to wear this. And if it's a gift to you, you have all the rights. So he gave me these falcon feathers to make me more swift in my life and to make, you know, and to, for, so that I can dodge the bullets and the arrows of my enemies. And he presented them to me, and I put them in my bowler hat now, and that's where they're going to stay. And it's just these little tokens of friendship and trust. Calvin Grinnell, the Hadassah elder, came into my studio a couple years back, and he called me on the phone and said, "Shane, I have your name." This is just out of the blue. I said, "What do you mean, Calvin, you have my name?" He goes, "Well, Shane, I have your name." I still didn't – I just wasn't registering what he was talking about. He says, "Well, I have your Native American name, Shane." He says, "I would like next Saturday to have a formal ceremony with exchanging of gifts. You need to get some witnesses together. You need to figure out how to make some soup, some traditional soup, and you need to exchange gifts. We need to have witnesses, and we're going to have this formal ceremony." And that's what we did. And he gave me the name. And I'm going to destroy this for all my Hadassah friends, but forgive me. Mishdekagoche, which means shadow catcher in Hadassah in this formal ceremony. We didn't do any recording of that ceremony. We didn't take any pictures during the ceremony. And it was a really formal, it was more formal than, you know, when I was confirmed or anything like that. And for me, it was the largest honor of my life. And at that point, you know how I was dedicated to this series up to that point. But the moment I was called Shadow Catcher, and now these are not strangers coming into my studio. They're my brothers and sisters. And it doesn't, and I can't explain that because, again, we don't have anything in our culture that's as significant, or I shouldn't say as significant or as relative as this, or to make sense to like compare this to. And, you know, it's not a group. It's not I'm a member of the Elks. You know what I mean? It's something much more significant than that. And I'll have a complete stranger come into my studio and they'll give me a hug. I never met them before. They'll come. They'll know that I'm Shadow Catcher. They'll give me a hug, and they'll call me Shadow Catcher. And to get a hug from a complete stranger the moment you meet them at the doorway of your studio, I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's a profound honor to carry this name. And I was dedicated to this series before, but since then, it's like I have to finish this series. I cannot let my brothers and sisters down. I cannot let them down. I'm dedicated to this, and I will not be swayed.
It's beautiful work, and it's very, very important work, by the way. Before I forget, how many images do you currently have in the North Dakota State Historical Society?
I want to say we went over 600 about 3 or 4 months ago. So there's 600 portraits there, and they're not all Native Americans, obviously. I've got your portrait there because, you know, you were the mayor at the time, and it was a popular thing for photographers to capture a picture of the mayor, capture a picture of the banker, maybe the butcher, you know, a realtor, or some you know, significant, a little bit of a cosmos of who we are at this time. And that's what I've been doing. So I've got musicians up, Kat Perkins, I've got her wet plate, you know, anyone of, you know, that I can befriend and capture and kind of just show, you know, who we are today. It's what I'm doing. So what an honor. I mean, I don't know of any other photographer that has the ability to take a portrait on a Friday and by Monday hand it over to the State Historical Society, and they've seen, I'll take that and put it in our museum indefinitely. I mean, that is not something that should ever be taken lightly. I don't know of any other photographer, and I know thousands of photographers, that has that capability. It's just their belief in what I'm trying to do. And it's my openness and the fact that I've never charged for this series. My Native Americans have never paid me. I've never sold a plate to make money. And at all the plates that I give to all these different institutions, it's all gifts. Because for me, it's about, capturing the history and honoring the person in the image. It's something that I just don't want to take advantage of, and I just want to continue to capture people and try to document who they are.
And it'll be there 400 or 500 years from now.
Yes, and these silver plates, silver doesn't degrade. So prints and other photographs, they have all kinds of issues up there at the Historical Society managing their other photo catalogs, because all these other films and all these things, they all fall apart over time, and prints get faded and things degrade. Silver on a piece of glass, properly varnished, will be silver on a piece of glass, properly varnished 1,000 years from now. And that's one of the beautiful things about the archivability of these images. And it becomes very historic. And we abandon this gorgeous photographic process. I mean, you come into my studio and you have all this technology in your life and you still think what I'm doing in that tray is magic. Can you about imagine what the Native Americans thought back when, you know, Orlando Scott Goff pulled up with his horse and wagon and asked to take a picture of a chief? I mean, if you're in modern day thinking what I'm doing is magic, it must have been just phenomenal to them. And that's why they called. And the reason why I got my name, Kelvin, a photographer to the Native American community was generally termed the shadow catcher. So they would say the shadow catcher's coming. And they were referring to not one particular person. They're referring to someone with a camera. And they thought, because you would take the picture of the chief, and if I drove away in my buggy and my horse, and I still had that piece of glass or tin that had his image on it, you can see how they would think, well, how can – our chief is still standing here with us, but that gentleman's leaving on a horse with our chief in a bag or an image of the bag or whatever that represents on the bag. And you can see there was that little struggle. In my documentary on Amazon, Dakota Goodhouse goes into this in detail about what he felt the first time that I captured his shadow. And he describes that he had this urge to break the plate. Like he didn't want that reality to be transferred to the plate. And he describes it as an urge to break the plate. And that's his perspective. And I love that perspective. Ernie LaPointe in this photograph, underneath that, his shirt in this photograph, Ernie had a talisman or a bag around his neck protecting him. Whatever's in that bag from me capturing a shadow.
You know, your work, Shane, hasn't taken place without controversy in terms of, I'm just going to call it like it is, small-minded, cold-hearted, bully-type individuals that attempted to destroy your work for whatever reasons.
My character?
Yeah, and your character. And we talked a lot about that. And I'm so happy that you're so resolute, you're so determined, and that the work and the significance of it pushed you through that. And that's about all I want to say about it, because I don't want to give them too much credit for them to you know, come around again.
I don't care if they come around again. I really don't. But what I'd say about that is, and I'm going to say it like it is, those idiots, okay, whoever they are, and we know who they are, I could not have hired a better PR person for my work than what they did. So in a way, I need to thank these lunatics. When I tried to get that photograph of Greta Thunberg installed in Bismarck, and it was – you know, they were boycotting and all the things that they were doing. There was 186 national and international newspaper articles picked up on that story. And my work was, you know, it was through the stratosphere on an international stage for doing what? For wanting to give a gift to the good people of North, you know, to Bismarck, where I was born and raised. So, I mean, we can just leave it at that. I don't need to cover this anymore. But the fact is that I could have went into a PR firm and said, this is what I want to achieve. I want to get my work into 178 different newspaper articles around the globe. You couldn't have achieved it. And they gave that to me. And they gave that to me out of the ignorance and the mean-spiritedness in their souls. And I rose above it. It wasn't easy, but it's and I'm not going anywhere. So
we had a number of conversations. By the way, how many museums, institutions is Greta's image now housed in as a result?
Well, We have murals. We have four murals, 8-foot murals around, including one down at Standing Rock. I had promised the people of Standing Rock that I would try to get to down on the Sitting Bull College down there. Greta's there. The original plate, the original plates, there's only the two plates that I was able to take. I had promised Greta and her father that I would not keep these plates, that I would find museums for them. And the first plate called Standing for Us All is at the Library of Congress. And then the other plate that I took of Greta went to the Nordiska Museet in her home country of Sweden. So I was able – and I was able to achieve that within about a week. So I make images, and a week later I have the Library of Congress and I have the Nordiska Museet saying, we'll take these works and protect them for you. And that was really my goal, was like, I didn't feel like it was something that I should hold on to. It wasn't, it's her likeness, my photograph, but it's her likeness, it's her legacy. And if it's her legacy, I have to have respect for her, and I've got to figure out where's the most significant place that I can put these original plates, so that if anyone looks up Greta Thunberg 750 years from now, they're able to be found. And I mean, the Library of Congress, I mean, that's insane. Yeah. And then in her home country as well, it was really rather magical. But they had promised when I shook her father's hand that I will get these plates into significant museums. And I feel like I lived up to that promise, which is really, really important. But her work's been on display. I mean, it was just in Japan. It was just in, I want to say it was Elle magazine just 6 months ago where, I mean, Japan, a whole article written about Greta Thunberg is in Japanese, and they use my imagery to tell this story. And it's a rather popular magazine in Japan as well. So it's gone all over. There's been museums have put her big print went on display in her home country as well, into another museum there. They had an exhibition about climate change and stuff. So. It continues to be shared around the world, and that's I really appreciate that.
So my last question. This is kind of an extension of our conversation of last week. If you had a magic wand, you could wave over the heads of individuals that are at a point in their life where they're searching for something of more significance than their daily grind, profession, whatever it is. And from my perspective, you know, first of all, making sure you have a good relationship with your maker. Mm-hmm. From someone that's gone through this now, what recommendation would you give? What's the one thing you'd want them to know in terms of that search?
Keep looking. But I also would say, you know, you have to chase things. You have to give in to some things sometimes. You have to take a chance sometimes. And you'll never know when you take a chance when a door will open and you just step in and you find yourself where you were always meant to be. But that's not, you know, you got to go down the line, open this door. Nope, it's not in there. Open this door. Nope, it's not in there. You can just keep looking, keep looking, keep looking. But trust me, if you do find it, like I feel like I found this, you're going to know it when you find it, and your life's going to be transformed. And the other thing is, you know, people, we all struggle, I think, unless we were born with a silver spoon in our mouth, that we all have a struggle. But once we get past that struggle, if you're fortunate enough, and some people, and I feel guilty. I feel genuine guilt sometimes on my successes and where I am in my life. That because I know that some people never get out of that. You use the word grind. They're always just trying to make it and valiantly trying to and struggling and having successes, but then having failures. And we all have that. But if you can get to the point like where I'm at, and who knows? I mean, I sit here in front of you so naively thinking that this is, you know, my story's already been written, but who knows? There's something could be coming at me that I'm not aware of, Mike, and I've got to be ready for that. But if you can get into a point in your life where you find that something and it changes your life, and if you can give back some way, if you can take everything, all the beautiful things that have been given to you and give back to someone else, someone that is still in the grind or is still struggling or needs to be uplifted or pick them up off the ground or whatever it may be. If you can take some of the resources that you've acquired and apply it and help somebody else, I mean, just think about that if everyone did that. If everyone, because even a person in poverty, and again, we're just talking about wealth and stuff on a superficial level, but even someone in poverty has something to give to someone, because there's always going to be someone poorer than even a person that you and I can imagine in poverty, right? So we can always find someone that has less than us and that we can give to. I think that can apply to someone who's got $10 or someone that's got $40 billion in the bank. The tragedy is those people that have that $40 billion. I really struggle with that. I really struggle. I really want to see those resources used somehow for good. It's just a personal pet peeve of mine that they can't possibly be giving enough for what they have. And if everyone could give what they could, and you don't have to give away 50% of your wealth. I'm not talking about that. You don't even have to give away any wealth. You just have to give away your time maybe in some scenarios, right? Go to a nursing home and just go hold the hands of some residents or wheel them down to the chapel or go help feed someone at the nursing home. You can do anything. Go walk some dogs snow blow some lady's driveway. I mean, if we can all just, hey, I can do something for someone else. And if we all did that, we'd all be winning.
Shane, what's the best way for people to follow your work?
I think if you just go to Google, type in Balkowitz, Balkowitsch, which is my last name. And if you type that in and type in wet plate, two words after that, There's many articles out there. You can, there's still some of the books. This is a limited edition book that you have here. Those are sold out. But volume two of my series will be coming out this fall yet, hopefully, with any luck. You can go to Amazon.com, Amazon Prime, Balkowitz, the same name is the name of the documentary that Greg Desai and Chelsea Severalli did on my work. These two filmmakers, their first time film, followed me around for a year and a half and did this film on zero budget. I didn't make any money on this. They surely didn't make any money. I mean, if you figure out how much money they made on all the hours they had putting that documentary together, I'm just in debt to them. But so there's other ways you could go. You can go onto Facebook and find Shane Balkowitz out there. And I've got it's called Nostalgia Glass Wet Plate Studio as well is my studio if you're interested in following my work and my journey. And I have a long way to go yet. I have another 8 to 10 years on this Native American series to get this properly done and get those four volumes of books done. So I just hope I have enough time and I'm blessed with enough time yet to finish this thing.
Well, Shane, you're an agent of change. You're doing wonderful things, important work. You're lifting up people that deserve to be lifted up and honored and capturing them for generations to come. I'm so glad that 9 years ago you saw a picture of a motorcycle. 2 years later, you sent a guy you didn't know a message, and that was me. And we've met. My life has been changed. I love you. You're a great guy. I appreciate you so much what you're doing. And we'll have to have you on again at some point in the future.
I would be honored, and I appreciate you taking the time and will let me share my story.
Thanks so much, Shane.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us today. You are profoundly appreciated. Where would I be without the team at Q1 Network? Anna DeVere, Ashley Harris, Bo Hastings, and Marlo Anderson. and my wife, Deb. Deb really orchestrates all of this for me. I have an incredible wife, partner, and friend. Thanks again for listening to Mike Seminary and Friends. Until we chat again, love y'all.